You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, SixthSense. SixthSense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With SixthSense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. To learn why enterprises choose SixthSense, visit SixthSense.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, historian curator here at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Spycast's sole purpose is to educate our listeners about the past, present, and future of intelligence and espionage. Every week, through engaging conversations, we explore some aspect of a vast ecosystem that looms beneath the surface of everyday life. We talk to spies, operators, mole hunters, defectors, analysts, and authors to explore the stories and secrets, tradecraft, and technology of the secret world. We are Spycast. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Today, I'm up at over 100,000 felonies. If you were to look at what I was able to do and the number of users I was able to compromise, from my perspective, it's the coolest job in the entire world. This week's guest is professional hacker Eric Escobar. Eric has legally compromised, well, almost everything, from healthcare and banking to technology and critical infrastructure, through to amusement parks and next-generation military aircraft. Listen in for part two next week. In part one, we touch on what keeps Eric up at night, thinking like a professional hacker, hardening your attack surface, i.e. protecting yourself and your information, and plain English explanations of important cyber concepts like kill chains and zero days. Hint, they're not the names of heavy metal bands. If you're a fan of the podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a kind review on Apple Podcasts. Make sure to check out this week's show notes for resources to learn more. Thanks for listening and enjoy this week's episode. I was just wondering, just to start off, Eric, so you're a professional hacker. You attempt to compromise all different types of networks, from the military through to amusement parks. I guess one of the first questions that I had just when I was thinking about this interview, you've seen quite a lot. Is there anything that keeps you up at night? Is there anything in the wee small hours where you're like, that one really like scares me?
You know, the ones that really keep me up at night are anything to do with critical infrastructure, which is, you know, obviously Colonial Pipeline and all the havoc that caused. Those are the ones that really just keep me up at night for a couple of reasons. I mean, really, if you look at any of our traditional, different internet uses, Amazon, you know, Google, Apple, like all these different services, what's the worst that's going to happen? You might lose some files, you might need to recover from a backup. Your information might get out there, but with all the critical infrastructure, there's chance of potential for loss of life, which is way worse than anything that can happen in the cyber realm. So those are the ones like watching any critical infrastructure get compromised is really the thing that keeps me up at night because, lives are in the balance, lives are on the line. And we do a lot of testing for critical infrastructure. And I've seen computers and machines that have been online and not been taken offline longer than I've been alive. So when you think about how often you have to reboot your machine and it's like, well, these haven't been rebooted in my lifetime. So it's really interesting to see those types of things because you know, that interact with really big, expensive hardware. And so there's a catch 22 that happens where you can't really take the machine offline to do maintenance on it because it's critical infrastructure. So then how do you test it to make sure that a hacker can't take it offline or maintenance can't be done on it, right? So to answer your question, critical infrastructure is what really keeps me up at night because of the actual physical harm that it could do in the world.
Wow. And before we met today, I mentioned that some of our listeners are involved in this business, some of them are involved in intelligence business, and some of them are just people on the street that love a good spy story or that are trying to get up to date with what's happening in the world. So just to give them a better understanding of what we're talking about here, at the Spy Museum, we have a shard from the Aurora generator test in 2007, which basically is a test to prove that a piece of code can affect the physical world. And basically, to cut a long story short, they blew up a generator. So something that's intangible can affect the tangible world. So that's ultimately what you're talking about. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my actual job, is doing exactly that. Not too dissimilar. A couple of weeks ago, we compromised an oil refinery. So that same exact, we're able to access, industrial control systems. And if we touch the wrong computer, if we do something wrong, things go boom. And so that's why it's my fear, because exactly that code can affect the real world in those, in those circumstances.
Okay. Wow. And how did you get into this business, Eric? How did you end up? Because your background, our intern at the moment's father, who's a civil engineer, your background's in civil engineering. So tell us a little bit more about that transition.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was in high school, I was like, man, I want to do some engineering. I'm good with math, good with science. So I did the survey of all the different types of engineers that there were. There's a class that my high school offered. And so it was either computer engineering or it was civil engineering. I was like, you know what? I don't want to be behind a desk all day on a computer. So I'm going to go into civil engineering and build real things out in the real world. So I go to school, get a master's degree in civil engineering, get my, I'm a registered civil engineer still in the state of California, in the United States. And I started working for a couple of years and they kept sending me out to these very remote places. And I was like, hey, I'm getting married. I'm going to have wife and kids here soon. I can't be out on all these, remote places doing random work out in the field. And so then, as luck would have it, my college roommate, his dad was a, head of security for a large company in Silicon Valley. And he goes, you know what? You got the mind for this. Do you want to, I'll replace your engineering salary if you just want to give this a go. And so I looked at, I talked it over with my soon to be wife, and I was just like, so how are we feeling about this? And she's like, no time like the present. So I made the hop from civil engineering into the security industry, and I never looked back. I still do some random, engineering stuff on the side if there's a unique problem that arises. But yeah, it's a weird, windy path, and it all comes back to the who you know and the connections that you make, and you never know how they're going to reform or impact you later on in life.
So before this interview today, I was at the National Cryptologic Museum, which is reopening after a refurb, and there they, in the early days of American cryptography, they didn't test so much for what people knew at that time. They tested for particular ways of thinking. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about what are some of the similarities between the way that civil engineers think and systems engineers and people that are working in your field think. What are some of the things that carry over that mean that if you think in that particular way, you'll be good in this field?
Yeah, I think it just comes down to problem solving and enjoying a good puzzle. When you're a civil engineer, you're looking for, hey, I need to get water from this dam to this hydroelectric facility, or I need to build this building and it needs to hold 1,000 people. And so you're looking at, you have constraints of time, resources, budget, all of that stuff, right? And so you're trying to solve that problem of how do I achieve this objective with the limited constraints that I have? And that's exactly what hacking is in the same regard of, hey, I'm trying to, compromise your Active Directory, compromise your oil refinery, break into this aircraft, and I have a very limited amount of information. How do I achieve this objective? So really, it's just problem solving and always loving a good puzzle.
So, and with this field that you're in and being a professional hacker, Is there any space for people like me and Erin, people that are more humanities type folk, or is it still a preponderance of people that are like math, engineering, that type of mind?
No, I mean, honestly, it's the full spectrum. The amount of people that we have on our team. So my background is civil engineering, right? If you were to take a survey of our team and say, what are your backgrounds in? We have several English majors. One of our best hackers used to be an RV salesman. We have a PhD in physics. So we all kind of meander and find our way into this career through, everybody's story is completely unique, just like mine is. But a lot of us come from the humanities aspect of it. And really the aspect there that I think is most interesting is the ability to communicate to your clients who are running these systems. Because yes, I'm very technical, but if I can't explain something in such a way to somebody who is maybe not as technical as I am, then my complete job has failed and fallen apart if I can't communicate that accurately. And so I always make the joke to my wife, who's an English major, that I never thought that I would be writing this. Like, I went into engineering so I wouldn't have to write a word a day in my life. And now I read, several thousand pages of reports as I QA them for our team. And then I have to write several hundred page reports a week for our clients. So the humanities, it's definitely one of those things, just the ability to communicate, the ability to pull from historical, precedent and all that stuff. Pretty much the way that I see it for this industry is everybody has a unique skill set that is, wildly in need, even if you don't quite realize it yet.
One of the things that I find really interesting about that industry is that a lot of the barriers to entry that exist for other fields are different in the cybersecurity realm. So for example, if you want to be on the Supreme Court, you have to have been to law school. If you want to be in the Supreme Court, you don't have to have been to 3 or 4 law schools in the whole country, but it's pretty much a certainty that you're only going to get onto it unless you've been to one of those 3 or 4 law schools if we look at it historically. But it seems to me that the barriers to entry are different in the field that you're in. And it also seems like, I could be naive or idealistic, but it seems like it's more meritocratic in that sense, because it's like you turn up in a kitchen as a chef. People don't really give a monkey's where you went to chef school. They're going to judge you based on what you cook for them. So I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit for us. I find that really interesting about the field that you're in.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's complete meritocracy. As far as if you are good at what you do and you can communicate it, you'll rise to the top. And that's absolutely what I love about it. And it's kind of funny because I have several of my friends who they see, Eric, this is what you do. Wow. You get to work from home. That's awesome. The pay is great. That's even better. And I'm like, you know what? You can do it too. And so I have a good friend of mine who was once a pastor, now turned hacker. And same thing. He's driven. He wants to do the work. He loves solving puzzles. And so he can apply all those communication skills and all of his other soft skills to the actual technical aspect of it. My wife's college roommate has a master's degree in biomedical engineering. And I was like, you know what? You could also do this too. And so sure enough, I keep trying to get, all my friends and family. And it's kind of a joke now where it's like, oh, Eric's going to try and recruit you, huh? But that's exactly it. The barrier to entry, you don't need a 4-year college degree to do this. When I started, there was no such thing as a cybersecurity program. And so if we did hire anybody, the closest match potentially would be a computer science degree. But really what we care about most, at least on our team, is your ability to communicate and your ability to solve problems and your ability really just to think on your feet. And those are, it's harder from one aspect because you can't teach it. You can't just decide, I want to do this and be incredibly successful at it. You might have a 4-year college degree in computer science. Heck, you might even be a PhD in computer science. But if you aren't going to be able to work a problem, think on your feet and communicate properly, it doesn't really matter what your credentials are. You can't teach it. A lot of this is something that you have to, innately have as a part of your personality. So from one end of the spectrum, it's awesome because somebody who could be good at it in, a year, you could show them everything that they need to know and they'll be off to the races. But on the other aspect of it, there's some things you just can't teach, just like any other profession or any other field. And so in that regard, I absolutely love it because if somebody shows a proclivity to it, if somebody shows that, hey, they're willing to invest the time to learn a new skill, the sky is the limit. We only need more adversarial testers. We only need more computer science
folks from all walks of life, right? So yeah.
And just thinking about this historically, when you see things like this in the past, quite often there's then a movement towards professionalization and certification and codification, and then those barriers get reestablished where if you want to get into Field X, you have to have ticked all of these boxes. Do you see that in tech, or do you ever think that that could really take off, or do you just think that it wouldn't really work for this particular field?
Yeah, you definitely see it now. So you see now that now there are degree programs or certification bodies, all these different things to, like you say, try and make it more professional, try and put a suit and tie on a hacker, right? I think to a degree, yeah, that they will, shut out potentially some, mostly because if you're trying to hire for, if you have a job opening for, hacker for hire, and you see that you have 100, 100 potential employees, and 50 of them have a 4-year degree in computer science or, security. If you're trying to just find a way to filter that down, you might just filter by that, and you might lose a bunch of great candidates. But if you're a human and you're trying to make sense of how do I, stack this, how do I sort and filter this stack of resumes in front of me, that might be a way that there could be some gatekeeping. But I even still feel like with that there are ways to break into the industry, even if you don't have that 4-year degree, even if you don't have that going forward, just because, like I said, it's a meritocracy. And if you have skills, if you have ability, you'll eventually find your way to a place that's going to appreciate and want and need those skills.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first realize that you had the chops to do this, or not just the chops? I don't want to embarrass you, but you went on to become and still are a very successful hacker. Like, when did you realize that, wow, this is somewhere where I can excel, as opposed to just, yeah, I guess I'll be able to keep a roof over my head and, stay out of jail and stuff like that. Yeah, when did it dawn on you that you this is somewhere where you could distinguish yourself?
I don't think it has yet. Have you ever heard of imposter syndrome?
Yeah, I've got it.
Everybody in this field, I shouldn't speak for everybody, but I would say if you surveyed this field, everybody feels like, I feel like they're an imposter to a degree. And for those in your audience listening, imposter syndrome is where you feel as if like, man, is somebody going to figure out that I don't know what I'm doing? There was one time my wife, she walks in my office and she's like, are you just Googling how to do something for your job? And I'm like, absolutely. And she's like, what if your coworkers, found out, or, would that be kind of funny? I'm like, oh no, we're all Googling all the questions. Nobody can know it all. And so really to answer your question, some people might look at me and be like, wow, Eric is a great hacker. He compromises and breaks in all these large companies. And then I have the people that I look up to, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you could never call me a hacker compared to, these individuals that I've met and these individuals that I know, they're the real deal. I'm just an imposter here. So I really don't think it's quite hit. I mean, it does pay the bills. Don't get me wrong. And I don't think I'm going anywhere anytime soon, but you're what's the saying? If you're the smartest one in the room, you're in the wrong room. And I don't think I've ever been in a room where I've been the smartest person. So, hopefully that answers that question. But I really every day feels like I'm an imposter to a degree.
We'll be right back after this.
Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit criticalstart.com and request a demo today. That's criticalstart.com. And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
And in this field as well, how much of it depends on current knowledge and how much of it just depends on this way of thinking and this skill set? So, for example, if you say you went into a, God forbid, say that a hacker, let's not say you, let's say a hacker went into a coma for 10 years and then woke up, it's different technology, different problems, but a lot of the underlying fundamentals are the same. How difficult would it be to get back up to speed? Is that like you need to start all over again? Or is it just, okay, you know how to think the right way, now it's just a case of slightly different technology or slightly different code?
I think you could take any person who is adept at solving challenges with constraints and they could get up to speed in this job in a year, be able to talk the talk, walk the walk, and in 2 years, be able to hold the conversation in a room of professionals and nobody would knew that you never touched a keyboard a day in your life. So realistically, my view anyways, is that it is not about the tools. It's not about, you know, how the systems interact and operate. It just comes down to being able to, you know, think on your feet. It comes down to being able to work through a problem with those constraints. And anybody with that mindset, I think that they could go into a coma for 100 years, wake up and still have that same of like, okay, I may not know anything. I may take some time to get up to speed, but it would not be like the nail in the coffin of like, oh, I waited too long. Like this has all gotten away from me, because technology changes so rapidly that I'll go on vacation. I went on paternity leave last year. And so, you know, I'm not hands on keyboard for like 3 months as, you know, taking care of kids and taking care of the family. And then I get back to it. I'm like, whoa, look at all these new attacks. This is really cool. You know, look at all these things that are now available, and look at all these things that previously, you know, we had no capability to test. And now, you know, oh, wow, we bypass full disk encryption on the laptop. That's incredible. So it really, I think it is just, if you're a problem solver, you could do this job. No problem. Doesn't matter when you decide to pick it up.
And full disclosure for our audiences, Eric was talking there, both Erin and I were on Craigslist looking for apartments in California, because I think we're both going to have a career change.
Please do. And I don't live in the cool part of California. I live in a place called Fresno, which is the agricultural, like, you know, capital of the world.
Heartland.
So, yeah, it is. It is. I see way more cows than I do waves.
It's grapes of wrath country, right?
Not wrong.
this is really, really fascinating. Just to take a step back, Eric, tell us a little bit more about SecureWorks, like the company that you work for, and tell us what you do there. So we know you're a professional hacker, but help us understand the connection between you and SecureWorks. What does your company do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, gosh, I feel like that's a loaded question, right? Like, I'm sure all of our marketing team and sales team are looking at me like, come on, say the right things, Eric. but essentially, SecureWorks is a security company, and we have a bunch of different departments within our company that all, you know, take care of one aspect of security. So I work on what's called our SWAG team, or SecureWorks Adversary Group. That's our acronym is SWAG, which is kind of cool. And basically, we're the adversarial team. Clients come to us and say, please try and break into us. Tell us how you broke into us. And so we can patch it before a nation state, you know, or another threat actor is able to break into them. And so that's why it's the coolest job in the entire world from my perspective, because on any given day, I'm committing several thousand felonies if I didn't have permission to do what I'm doing. Today, I'm up to over 100,000 felonies if you were to look at what I was able to do and the amount of users I was able to compromise. And so as far as like looking at the broader part of SecureWorks, I'm in the adversarial section where we attack our clients, you know, to try and make them more secure. But what's kind of neat is that we have a bunch of other, you know,
divisions, I guess is the best way to put it, within our company that do different aspects of security. So we have our incident response team. So basically, if your company were to get breached and find out, you've been breached, you can call us. Our guys will parachute in and basically say, hey, we're going to evict the threat actor, find out how they got in, patch the hole, and make it so that your company can function again, right? If there's ransomware, how do we recover from backups? Is there, potentially recovery keys somewhere? So that's incident response. So I break in, incident response responds when somebody like me that's not friendly breaks in. And then we also have our CTU team, our counter threat unit. Counter threat unit, they're responsible for seeing what does the adversarial landscape look like? What are nation states doing? What tools and techniques are being used by other threat actors that aren't friendly, out in the wild? And then can we take what we've learned from there and apply it to our defensive products so that we're able to make sure that an incident never happens because we catch it before it does, right? So you can think of them as like, the researchers in the field sampling all the things that are bad, taking it back home and writing, different definitions to be able to catch any of that malware going forward. Or, it doesn't have to be malware. It could be more often than not how threat actors operate and, their operating principles. And then we have our flagship product, which is Taegis. Taegis is like, it's an XDR platform. XDR is a fancy, basically, way of saying it is your enterprise way to monitor how threat actors are, potentially trying to pivot into your network, how they're trying to access your network. And, what does that look like? And can they catch that threat actor before, before they're able to do anything? So it's kind of a fun cat and mouse game that we, all those different divisions play against one another, because incident response is like, oh man, like how could we find out, what you're doing in your network? And, there's always a cat and mouse game that goes with our Taegis platform of, hey, can we bypass our own security product, right? And so it's a fun game to go back and forth and like, okay, we bypassed it here, then they patch it and then they can detect it and, just going back and forth. But really it makes everybody sharper on our team. And same thing with counter threat unit. We're pulling in stuff that's being used in the wild. So we can see, hey, what are threat actors in nation states and other, adversarial groups? What are they doing? What do we see? So that's a very quick and concise, summary of what we do. But it's really fun because you get it from all different angles. You get to see what's happening in the basically cyberspace on the internet.
Wow. And how do you spell that, Taegis?
I should know this. Taegis.
So this is like a model for just protecting a network?
Protecting a network. It's protecting
just protecting a network. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I did spell that right. I had to look it up just to make sure. Yeah. So it essentially goes, it looks at your network holistically and basically says, not just, hey, what is happening to the server? It looks at your network holistically and says, do we notice weird patterns? Do we see machines that have maybe not connected to other machines? Do we see authentication attempts that shouldn't be from certain hosts? It does a wide range of different things to look, not just at one single endpoint device. Not, hey, was this one computer compromised, but evidence of compromise throughout your entire network. Because oftentimes, if I'm going to break into, to get a little bit technical, if I'm going to break into your network, I typically don't like to use malware. I typically don't like to use, some tool that's going to get captured. What I typically do is find a way to gain credentials, someone's username and password, and then I use their user account to basically do everything throughout their network. So there would be no malware to find because I'm using their network and their accounts as they should be used and finding vulnerabilities and weaknesses in their permission authentication schemes that, is basically undetectable because I'm not using malware. And so there's a lot of pattern matching, a lot of, really technical stuff on their side of the house, to prevent and discover things that are anomalies, so to say.
Okay. When you say a security company, you mean cybersecurity?
Cybersecurity
company. Is that correct?
Yeah. Although we do, so as part of our adversarial testing, we also do physical security as well. So I've, done the whole secret agent break-in, clone badges, go in at night, pick the lock and all that stuff as well.
Oh, you have? Wow. Okay. Yeah. One of the things that I'm interested in is, with this field, like Spycast is on the CyberWire network now. And we've done traditional intelligence espionage and people kind of get that more or less, okay, that's over here. And then they sort of get cyber, they're like, okay, that's computers, that's over there. I'm increasingly interested in the places where they overlap. And it seems that, you know, a lot of people are like, okay, well, the NSA, like, that's an area where, you know, both of them overlap. And other than that, it gets a bit fuzzy and I'm not sure about it. But, you know, when you hear the term InfoSec, like information security, I mean, that's what a lot of what intelligence agencies do. Or when you were speaking about, like, breaking in without using malware, it's like intelligence agencies as well. Sure, you can do some kind of brute force attack and get information, but if you scream out that you've just done something, then they're going to go away and change all their codes and do a whole bunch of countermeasures to try to protect themselves against what you've just committed against them. So I don't want to say that both of them collapse into one another, but it just seems really interesting to me, all of the places that they overlap. And I don't know if I've ever read a book or something that adequately explains that overlap, but what do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, so InfoSec, like, I think all the, like, the industry terminology is always kind of funny, because you say, oh, I'm an InfoSec, and everybody's like, I don't know what that means. And it's like, that's really fair. And so when you think about it, you know, you expand it out, information security. And so a lot of people are like, oh, so you safeguard, you know, the typical things, right? Your health data, your financial data, your, you know, all these different things that you think of when you think of, like, oh, my online accounts is what is being safeguarded. Well, it's interesting when you think about it, you know, so you mentioned, you know, ways that they overlap. Really, it's just information. You know, if you're a spy agency, if you're a nation state and you're trying to discern information, there's a lot of guesswork, a lot of educated guesswork that goes into that. And so an example that I always kind of like to think about realistically, if you look at, say, the United States political landscape, totally not a hot button issue. If you are a foreign, you know, nation and you're trying to understand, hey, what, you know, what are the political parties, you know, angling to do? What's going on here? Well, think if they were able to break into, say, the, you know, manufacturer of like flags, right? Of little American flags that would get waved around at campaign rallies. Well, if you knew how many orders of each of those flags were going to respective, you know, different political campaigns and parties and all that stuff, well, now you've built up, just with that information of orders of flags, if you're able to compromise a small manufacturing place, now you know all the ordering, all the processing information of how that goes, typically logistics of who, how, where, and why those flags are going to be in that position. You typically know how many are in the war chest or how many people they're expecting at a campaign rally, right? And so it's one of those things that it's information security, because you don't necessarily know how the information is going to be used. You know, you might have a threat actor that breaks in trying to that same flag company, trying just to steal, you know, email addresses so that they can send out, you know, phishing emails just willy-nilly. Or you might have a nation state trying to compromise that same flag factory for the purpose of trying to divine what does the political landscape look like in the United States for the upcoming midterms. There's a lot of hypotheticals, and then there's a lot of, like, oh, you know, where things actually overlap, like you said, with NSA and other intelligence agencies.
And even for, it seems to me that even for, like, for someone like you that's in the private sector, this is still part of your world, because the companies and so forth that you're doing this penetration testing for, this hacking for, it seems to me that quite a few of them will be trying to protect themselves against nation state actors like Russia and China and hacker groups that are affiliated with intelligence agencies from those countries. So, that's quite interesting as well. It seems to me that whether, you know, you don't have a choice in the matter almost, because nation states have a large amount of resources, they can put manpower to a problem for decades and decades, theoretically, or even longer. So people like you are up against these foreign intelligence agencies. It's not like a matter of choice. It just is. That's quite interesting to me.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head. Is the way that I always like to think about it is that if I said, hey, Andrew, you know what? I'm going to send 12 special force operators to come break into your house. And if I said that and then, you know, got plastered all over the news, oh my gosh, can you believe Andrew, he got compromised because 12 Navy SEALs kicked in his door. Everybody would be like, well, yeah, it's a normal person against 12 well-trained Navy SEALs. Of course that's going to happen.
What do you expect?
But realistically, in the cyber domain, it's even worse, because you have nation states that are funded with millions and billions of dollars potentially targeting, you know, a small company, a medium-sized company, even a large company. Even if you look at a large company and you said, hey, 12 Navy SEALs, kick your way in the door, you know, a lot, you know, the news, the, you know, the media apparatus would be a lot more friendly saying, oh, well, yeah, no one would expect that they should be able to withstand an attack against a nation state. But that's what we're asking everyone to do. I mean, that's what we're asking you and I to do every time we're trying to protect our email, every time we're trying to use encryption for anything, login passwords to Facebook, Instagram, all your social media accounts. All of these things have to be able to defend themselves against, you know, the latest and greatest technology threat actors and, you know, the equivalent of the digital Navy SEALs. And that's exactly it, is that we are having to, you know, do this not by choice, but because this is the state of the world. And not only, you know, to break down the analogy even more of like 12 Navy SEALs kicking in your door, they can do that from their respective country. So they don't even have to like get out of bed, you know, to potentially perform that attack. Whereas if they were, you know, physical actual operatives, they would have to. And so that's just the reality of where we live, is that, you know, all of this information is constantly being attacked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from, you know, like hacking groups that are built out of teenagers, right? The most recent hacks, I think, of Uber was tied to Lazarus Group, which is a bunch of teenagers, right? I could be totally wrong on that. I'm pretty sure. I think that's right. But the analogy stands up. It could be anybody. It could be nation state. It could be a bunch of teenagers across the world. So it's one of those things that when you frame it in that mind, you're like, yeah, that's a really hard problem, because turns out countries have a lot of resources that if they want to break in somewhere, they can apply hundreds of people potentially to focus on one problem, you know, to put in all that brain power and trying to break in.
I like that analogy, the Navy SEALs. I was also just thinking that the Navy SEALs can't break your door down while eating a bag of Cheetos, but a hacker overseas can, right?
Absolutely. It's funny. There's been several times where it's like, oh, I'm making dinner, or, you know, like, got to watch the kids right now, you know, before, if they woke up from their nap early. So it's like, wow, I'm breaking into a Fortune 500 company while like hanging out with my four-year-old.
That's funny. And this is where this term APT comes from, right? Advanced Persistent Threats. That's a nation state that can just throw relatively infinite amounts of money and time at a problem.
Yeah, and it could be a nation state. It could be combinations of nation states. It could be really well-resourced, you know, threat actors. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a nation state, but yeah, advanced persistent threat. And they're typically named. You know, a lot of different threat actors, they have, you know, similar processes, they have similar techniques, similar tools. And so you can kind of aggregate those, like what our CTU team would do is they basically say, okay, there's this hacker group that we don't know anything, or, you know, we don't necessarily know like, oh, this is who they are, but we can tell from their attack pattern and like what they're doing that this is probably a similar group, and they might have some crossover, but not necessarily needs to be a nation state, but definitely well resourced and definitely professionals in the field of what they're doing.
Wow. And one of the things that I wanted to ask as well was, can you break down this term kill chain for us? I've heard this like used quite a lot, and I know that in the realm of cyber it's quite important, and for some of our listeners, this will be, you know, something that trips off their tongue, but for others, they'll be, what the heck are they talking about? So what's the kill chain?
Yeah, so I'll give you a brief example with a story of a test that we recently did. So kill chain, in like a one sentence thing, is basically how you're able to achieve your objective, how you're able to compromise somebody from the beginning to the end. So if you're reading a book, it's just a quick story, a quick narrative of how were you able to do it? So for like one of our tests, we're trying to break into this medical facility, and we're trying to break into it from the public internet. So just like any other internet user has the same level of access as we do. And they give us, hey, here's our target computers to break into. We found, hey, there's a page publicly available that says, have you forgotten your password? Click here to reset it. You only need to answer some security questions. So we found a list of users on LinkedIn, and we compared them to the social media profiles such as Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, all these publicly available social media things. And we found some of the questions were things you can probably look up on social media. So one of them was like favorite superhero. Found the person's Facebook page instantly. Obviously it's Batman. And so it went from there. And so we had one of their security questions already. The next question was their maternal mother's maiden name or maternal grandmother's maiden name. So something seems pretty abstract until you stumble upon an obituary that contains that same information. So now we're able to reset this user's password. We reset their password. We're able to log into their VPN. So the way that they remotely access their company. And then from there, we're able to impersonate them on the network. We're then able to access a file share on their network. And now from the public internet, we're accessing a server within their internal corporate network. Turns out that file server had, you know, some vulnerabilities with it, and it was able to basically access a more secure server. So we're able to go into from one file server into a more secure server, which contained the entire company's username and password database. And so I was then able to extract all the information sitting from the public internet. So that's essentially what a kill chain is. All the different steps that you use to achieve that objective of whatever the client wants or however a company was compromised. So does that make sense? Hopefully I explained that okay.
I think so. So it's like going over a bridge, and then at each stage of the bridge, there's the potential to be stopped or the potential not to complete your journey. And you have to keep completing every 50 meters to get to the end. And the kill chain is just, if you can stop them over the length of the bridge, get into the end of the bridge, then does that make sense? Or is that not a good analogy?
That's very similar of just, you're trying to find a path to achieve your objective. And for us, the kill chain is how, all the different steps that you achieve that objective. And then what's nice is that when we generate a report for our clients, we basically say, here are like, you know, the 10 or 15 key steps. Had you stopped us at any point along the way in these steps, then you would have potentially stopped us from the compromise. And then, you know, so that's like a chain, if you think about like a physical chain, but then it's also can be more like a web from the standpoint of like, there's more than one way to, you know, to potentially compromise. And so there's all the, you know, additional kill chains potentially and how those stem and weave. But yeah, that's the nail on the head is where can you get stopped along that path of compromise.
And help us understand a little bit more as well about hardening the attack surface. So that's one of the terms that I've heard. How do you harden an attack surface? Break that down for our listeners.
Yeah. So say you're just a standard computer user, right? You have your standard laptop, and let's talk about like hardening your laptop, or, you know, this sounds like a really, oh, we got to harden, no, secure, you know, batten down the hatches kind of thing. And really, it's not that dissimilar from just like if you're in standard, you know, large companies try to harden their systems just like you could harden your laptop. So, hey, maybe the password that you used to log into your laptop, maybe that's just, you know, a 4-digit code. Well, if you're trying to harden it, make it harder for somebody to get in, instead of having a 4-digit code, maybe use a sentence that's like 15 characters long, so it's easy to type in your keyboard. That would be one way that then I couldn't just potentially guess what your password is, you know, if it's 4 zeros in a row. Other things that you might do is, hey, I'm not going to, you know, potentially connect to like public Wi-Fi. Or if I am, I'm going to use something like a VPN to protect my internet traffic as it leaves my computer. Other things of like trying to harden yourself might be something physical. I'm not going to leave my laptop in my backpack in the back of my car when I go to the grocery store, right? So so it doesn't have to just be in the you know, the digital domain. And there's a lot of things like that, like just enabling something like multi-factor authentication, which is like if you log into your bank, you log into something else where you get like a text message or you have to, you know, hit a button on your phone. Just adding those simple things is hardening, you know, your attack surface, is limiting your attack surface so that if I'm trying to break into, say, your Facebook, your Gmail, your Instagram, and there's a second factor authentication, I would basically need to steal your phone in order to, you know, get that second factor of authentication. And same thing, if you're using a hard, unique password that I couldn't just guess, well, good luck then. There's this something else that I don't know. So that's really all that it is it's a really simple concept of just you're limiting the way that somebody like me is going to be able to easily break into you and just creating more and more barriers of difficulty.
Okay. So it seems like defense in depth. Rather than one huge wall, like in the Game of Thrones, it's just here's like 2 dozen walls where I'm going to make it really difficult for you to do this, and it's probably going to be easier for you just to go somewhere else and make your life easier.
And that's the, so there's always an analogy that I like to, or it's more of a joke. of you're camping with your buddy, you and your buddy at your campsite, and a bear stumbles into your campsite, and you start putting your shoes on, and your buddy leans in and he says, "There's no way you're going to outrun that bear." And he goes, "I don't need to outrun that bear. I just need to outrun you." And that's that's exactly what
like
it is.
That one.
hackers are lazy. We're opportunistic, and we're not going to struggle and try and crack the hardest server if the next server over is going to be something that is old and outdated and easy to compromise. We're always going to go find the path of least resistance. And so, in that same case, if you are a hardened target, if you're a target that has multi-factor authentication, unique passwords for everything, and long passwords. I'm not necessarily going to go after you. I'm potentially going to try and find another way, either into your system through somebody else, or I'm, just going to leave you alone altogether. And so that's really all that it is just adding, it's like layers of security, right? So, there doesn't have to be, like you said, one big wall, but hey, little incremental steps that you could do just to make it my life harder as a hacker.
Okay. And just before we move on from, these definitions, which are really, really helpful, by the way. Thanks so much for doing this and indulging me. 0 days, this is the last one. Help us understand what 0 days are.
Yeah, so 0 days, the quick definition of it is it's basically a vulnerability or an exploit in a system that nobody knows, that no company is aware of. And so the reason where it gets the term 0 days is it's days since it was discovered. So say a vulnerability is found in Windows and it's been, a certain number of days since it's been discovered. So it's been 10 days, it's been, 11 days, it's been, 3 months. So how many days passed since it's been discovered? Has it been out in the wild? And 0 days are at zero because they are out in the wild and nobody knows about them potentially. And so the reason that 0 days are so, I guess like mythical or, so scary is because you could be, using a fully patched iPhone, and that fully patched iPhone, completely up to date, all the security stuff, technically as secure as an iPhone could be. If it has a 0 day in it, that means that a threat actor or an attacker potentially has access to it, even though it's been completely patched, completely updated, and has all the latest security definitions. And that's what makes it so scary, is that you don't even know that you're vulnerable because because nobody else in the world other than the attacker potentially knows that this vulnerability exists. And so that's why it's called 0 day, because hasn't even basically been released. Nobody's aware of it. And that's the reason that they're scary, is because, again, Apple recently patched a couple 0 days where, hey, they found out iPhones are being actively exploited and against fully patched, updated, devices. And so they had to release, once they discovered it, then they released patches and, all that stuff to update your phone, which is why you should always keep your devices up to date. But that being said, that's basically the simple definition of it, is just something that is not known to the rest of the security community.
And how did these things come to light? Like, with 0 days, is there malicious actors out there that are just specifically hunting down 0 days, or is it someone stumbles across it that works for a company, puts it on the dark net and says, I'm offering this for this amount of Bitcoin or something, send it to this address? Yeah, help the average person on the street understand how these things come to light, or not come to light for everybody, because the whole point is that you get access to this before other people know about it, so you can take advantage of it. So help us understand how these things like bubble up and come to the surface.
Yeah, so there are dedicated researchers that they spend all of their time, looking for very specific vulnerabilities into very specific systems. That's not everybody. That's not how all 0 days are discovered. But what's interesting is that there's a term called bug bounties, where basically companies say, hey, if you find a 0 day, if you find a vulnerability by chance or because you're a researcher in any of our systems, we'll pay you a certain amount of money per level of the vulnerability to report it to us and let us know. So I think, Apple has some crazy like $2 million bug bounty, so that if you did find a 0 day in the most up-to-date, iOS, and you report it to them, you get, several hundred thousand dollars for sure. And I think maybe up to $1 million is the most that's ever been paid out. So companies will pay to say, hey, if you find it to us, report it to us, and like all above board, all, we'll send it to you. You're not a criminal. You are more than allowed to try and find this stuff. And if you report it to us and do responsible disclosure, completely, please let us know, make the world a more secure place. sometimes you just stumble into them. So there's been several, you know, websites, applications that I've looked at, and, you know, you get into like a weird edge case where you're like, oh, if I just don't put a username in this field and hit submit, it logs me in as an administrator. Well, that's a vulnerability. And was I trying to do anything nefarious? No, not necessarily. It could have just been an accident. But that's technically a 0 day. So it's, you know, there's researchers, it spans the whole spectrum of researchers who are dedicated to like only looking at certain platforms for high paying bounties. And then there are, you know, just people that stumble across a vulnerability. And just because it's a 0 day doesn't mean that it is, you know, actually weaponized or anything. It might be like, oh, I noticed that there's a flaw in this application. So maybe the 0 day doesn't actually get me any like really great access or really great ability to do something, but still nobody knows about it. And if it helps you as a part of your kill chain, then yeah, it could be kind of a scary 0 day, but not all 0 days are like, and then we got access to all of his text messages and just from his phone number. But yeah, does that make sense as far as like the ranges of what's out there?
It does. Yeah, that's really helpful. And tell me if I've understood this properly. So one of the ways that I have thought about this in the past is a 0 day is like Buckingham Palace, where you can go around and make sure that every single window is closed. But if one window out of 15,000 is not closed and no one knows that it hasn't been closed, then the whole palace is potentially vulnerable if someone knows where that one window that hasn't been closed is. Would that be a good analogy?
That's pretty spot on as far as I always tell my clients, look, I have the easy job. I need to find one way in. You have the hard job. You have to, you know, basically make sure all of those windows are all completely closed. In the past, it used to be exactly like that of like, hey, you find one window open, game over. You've completely taken over the entire thing. Different applications, different websites, different, you know, physical devices like iPhones and Android phones. They're starting to implement, or not starting, they have implemented additional security layers and security features so that, say you're to compromise an iOS app or an app on an iPhone, you know, there's things like the secure enclave, to get really technical, that keep, you know, things like keys and private data secure on those devices. So, you know, for some networks, you know, there are some times where if you get a 0 day on that network, or if you're able to compromise that network, you have the keys to the kingdom and you can run around all of Buckingham Palace, you know, scream atop of your lungs and you have, you know, you are good to go. And then there are other, you know, in a lot of time it's from larger companies that have, you know, different layers of, you know, of security aspects in place that make it so that, hey, maybe you got in through the entryway, but you're never going to make it down the hallway into, you know, bedroom chambers or something like that.
And in the context of Buckingham Palace, the kill chain would be everything that's trying to stop you getting into the Queen's, sorry, RIP, the King's bedroom.
Yeah, the King's bedroom.
It would be the fence. It would be the electronic security system. It would be the dogs. It would be the security team. It would be the windows. It would be the material of the windows. It would be the sensors in the hallways. All of those things are trying to stop you getting through to the end.
Yeah. And so the kill chain in this perspective is all the different things that an attacker did. So, you know, did they, like you said, did they bypass the motion sensors? Did they jump the gate? All the different things that they were able to do that if any one of them had worked properly and kept out the attacker, you know, that kill chain wouldn't exist. The kill chain is all the things that were breached along the way.
And in the context of your job, you would try to get into Buckingham Palace. And then when you got in, you would say, here's how I got in and here's how you need to harden the attack surface.
Yep. And that's exactly it. And it's funny because you bring up the Buckingham Palace example, but the thing that I always tell our clients are, hey, look, I can steal user passwords all day. I can access files, shares all day. Tell me what your crown jewels are and what keeps you up at night. And so when you say Buckingham Palace, it's funny because I always tell our clients, tell me what your crown jewels are and that's what I'll go steal. And I'll tell you exactly how I stole them so that you can, you know, block every aspect of that kill chain so that if somebody like me were to come back, all those things have been patched, blocked, updated, or remediated in some way.
It would be funny if the Royal Palace reached out to you and said, and you said, you know, what's your crown jewels?
The actual crown jewels, Eric. All right. Challenge accepted. Let's go.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Spycast. Go to our webpage where you can find links to further resources, detailed show notes, and full transcripts. We have over 500 episodes in our back catalogue for you to explore. Please follow the show on Twitter at @intlspycast and share your favourite quotes and insights, or start a conversation. If you have any additional feedback, please email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, and you can connect with me on LinkedIn or follow me on Twitter at @spyhistorian. This show is brought to you from the home of the world's preeminent collection of intelligence and espionage-related artifacts, the International Spy Museum. The Spycast team includes Mike Mincy and Memphis Vaughn III. See you for next week's show.